Hey, you came back and we're glad. Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We're online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. And the most is just like America's Most Wanted, except instead of talking about remorseless murders on the lam, we're talking about the most emailed and most viewed stories from around the internet. And instead of John Walsh, it's Allison and me and our producers. And this is the most. Caitlin Kenny, you're going first.
All right. I have the most emailed story from the San Francisco Chronicle, and it's about Food Network star Robert Irvine. He hosts the show Dinner Impossible. You may have seen it. They give him, like, a crazy amount of time and crazy conditions, and he has to prepare this amazing meal. Well, turns out some of the claims he made about having cooked for Britain's royal family and various U.S. presidents are not, in fact, true. The St. Petersburg Times in Florida did a story on it. He claimed to have worked on the wedding cake for Princess Charles and Princess Diana. In fact, he was merely at the school at the time, and the cake was made at the school. When he was asked about a specific contribution, he's like, oh, maybe I picked some of those fruits. In regards to cooking for the White House, the guy who was the actual cook at the time said he was in a training program a few years before, but never actually cooked any meals for any U.S. president. So,
resume inflation.
Yeah, the Food Network's pulled the plug. Well, he's going to finish out his series, but they're not going to renew his contract, and they're looking for another star.
And somebody was happy about this morning.
Gotta admit, I'm not a big fan. He prepares these elaborate meals. They put him, like, on a golf course, and he still comes out with this amazing thing.
You think
he's
cheating him on a golf course?
Yeah, there was one where he was on a golf course, and he made, like, this crazy lobster dish, and I was like, there was, like, not good refrigeration. It just seemed
really
sketchy.
Maybe he's just really good, Caitlin.
Right.
I don't think so, but.
Hey, she won the bake-off, so she can pass judgment.
That's true. You're a good judge.
One chef to another.
Dan Pashman.
Hey, guys. I'm wearing my most complimented shirt ever. That's the first most going on
That's
here.
That's an appropriate most comment. It is. Yeah. It's a very nice shirt.
I mean, thank you. I don't mean to even deflect compliments, but I just, every time I wear it, I don't even know what it is. But anyway, another
we'll
most
put a picture
for
on the blog.
Yeah, that's right. I'm sure everyone's going to be running with that. We get most emailed here from the Boston Herald. Mom's brawl at Chuck E. Cheese party. Now,
I'd click on that.
We love this so much, but tell us why they got in a fight.
Well, they got in a fight. A fight broke out because one woman thought the other woman's son was, quote-unquote, hogging an arcade game. This is at a birthday party. One 9-year-old boy was apparently upset because someone else wouldn't let him get on a certain game. Words were exchanged, quote-unquote, and then it came to blows, and they had to be separated by employees. The police had to be called. Best quote of the article, the police sergeant said that what started as a birthday celebration turned into a, quote-unquote, birthday melee.
Now, my theory is that that place makes moms crazy, and I think Trish McKinney might agree with me.
Yes, it makes me crazy. No offense to Chuck E. Cheese. But, you know, flashing lights, crowds of children, people mowing you over at knee level, the noise. Never, I'm
the
sorry.
Large plushies. It just sends you, you can send a mom over the edge.
I love that she's worried about offending Chuck.
Yeah.
See, I don't want to hurt your feelings, Mr. Cheese.
Yeah. There's got to be a reason people show up in these enormous crowds that you can't navigate your way through. I've had enough.
I want them to start Chuck E. Cheese after dark and get rid of the kids like after 8 o'clock at night so I can have a party there.
And go jump in the big vat of plastic balls.
Somebody's
going to
get lost.
I want my birthday in the vat of plastic balls.
We'll work on that.
Thanks, guys.
Ian.
All right, this is the number one search term on Google Trends was Mothman. And Trish McKinney said, Ian, that sounds like something you'd be interested in, I think because yesterday I talked about the Lizard Man. But actually, the Mothman is this legend in West Virginia where I'm from. In this town called Point Pleasant in the late 60s, the town was plagued by images of this Mothman, this huge winged beast. Actually, there was an A&E special about the Mothman last night, which got all these people searching. But I have to say, In 67, that's when the Mothman was all over town. People were very scared. On December 15th, 1967, the Silver Bridge collapsed into the Ohio River. That's the bridge from Point Pleasant to Gallipolis, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
And this has always been a big story in my family because my mother was coming home from college that day. She was on a bus home from Ohio University. And her parents heard that this bridge collapsed, a bridge that she would often cross on her way home. So, you know, the days before cell phones, they were worried.
Panic.
They thought their daughter was gone. And they didn't find out she was safe until she got home. And a lot of people connect the Mothman with the Silver Bridge. Sorry about that. A lot of people, you know, say
I'm glad she was safe. And Ian what?
And finally, my mother is the Mothman.
But they thought the Mothman had gotten your mom? Was
yeah,
that the idea?
Yeah. Okay. People think maybe the Mothman was a sign that this bridge was going to collapse.
Oh, that's a good one. Matt Martinez.
Hi, how are you? Good. I have one of the most searched at MSN. It is Irukandi. It is a type of jellyfish. I'm going to spell it for you in case you want to do your own search, because it doesn't. It's not spelled the way it sounds. Irukandji. Irukandi. And it's this guy was stung by one of these jellyfish, died. They have some of the most potent venom in the world. And the jellyfish has been officially named after the guy that was stung and died.
Oh, no.
So it's now called the Malokingi after Robert King. He was stung in 19... No, it was discovered in 1999. And he's one of the guys who was stung. And they're tiny. I saw an Animal Planet. They're tiny little things. They're little.
Tiny
and it gives
killers.
You something called Irukandi syndrome. Mm. And it's seizures and like days of seizures before you die. And so you're basically in the hospital. It's an awful, awful thing.
It's not going to happen to you, Matt, I promise.
Well, I'm not going to Australia
Something
now.
Has to worry about.
I'm not flying anywhere. I'm not going to Australia. I am not going to touch anything ever again. I'm just going to go and put myself in a big, giant plastic sheet and boil me. Yes.
Giant human Ziploc for Matt.
That'll be pain-free.
Okay, my most emailed is from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and the headline is, St. Louis funeral had everyone fooled. Not sure fooled is necessarily the right word. 100 people gathered to attend the funeral of Frederick McWeathers Jr. He was 41 years old. Everybody called him Jr. His son was there. His grandfather, his father, excuse me. It wasn't him. It wasn't him. And the father had even ID'd him at the morgue. And said it's uncanny, like he must have a twin out there, because the guy,
everyone's got one.
The body that they pulled out and showed him had, was missing front teeth like his son, had a beard like his son, so it looked exactly like his son. He was absolutely convinced this was his son. The way they found out that Junior was still alive, Junior made a phone call from a crack rehab.
Yeah.
To his wife and said, by the way, I am not dead. I read about
I'm alive, but I am a crack addict.
The reason I'm making this call.
But the thing is, they think it's going to change the East St. Louis Police Department's policy because they didn't check the fingerprints after the dad ID'd him. And then after they checked, they were like, oh, yeah, this is not him.
You'd figure. You know, there's not enough episodes of CSI.
Yeah, so the reason they say fooled is some people think, were they after insurance money or something? But the grandfather said, hey, the $5,000 doesn't even pay for what we paid for this funeral for someone else.
Wow.
So...
guys, there were so many good things in the most. But we're not done. One of the most emailed stories at NPR.org right now at this very moment is part of NPR's Climate Connection series. It's a story by NPR's John Hamilton about how the Panama Canal could be affected by global warming. Let's listen to some of his report.
If you've ever bought shoes at Walmart or bananas at Costco, there's a good chance they came through the Panama Canal on a cargo ship like the Maersk Dartford.
We're looking at a Panamax ship, and it's going south.
Jorge de la Guardia works for the Panama Canal Authority. We're watching the Dartford squeeze through the Miraflores locks on her way from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific. Like thousands of ships around the world, the Dartford was built to what's become known as the Panamax standard. That's the maximum size that can still navigate the Panama Canal.
Panamax ship is defined as a ship of over 100 feet in the beam, and they usually are from about 850 feet to 965 feet in length.
The gap between the Dartford's steel hull and the lock's concrete wall is 2 feet. It's such a tight fit that pilots often use full power to force a ship into the lock like a cork into a wine bottle. Right now, about 4% of all world trade passes through the Panama Canal. It's the shortcut between the Atlantic and the Pacific. De La Guardia says Panamax ships like the Dartford pay about $250,000 for each crossing.
You know, the canal is the most important industry that Panama has. Because of the canal, we have ports. The port activity is increasing tremendously.
Ships pay to use the canal because the alternative is a 9,000-mile detour around Cape Horn on the southern tip of South America. The only other route is way north through the Arctic, and so far ice has made that a risky option. The need for a global shortcut was why a French company started building the Panama Canal at the end of the 19th century. The U.S. finished it in 1914. The canal is critical to international trade, especially between the U.S. and China. But there's a problem. International shipping companies are starting to use bigger ships because they're more efficient, and these new vessels are too big for the canal. So Panama is spending more than $5 billion on an expansion project. It includes a new set of locks that are much wider and deeper than the existing two sets. The project got underway officially last year. The expansion should be done by the canal's 100th birthday in 2014. That will solve the problem of accommodating bigger ships, but it's also creating a new problem. The canal depends on rain, and that's where climate change comes in. The Panama Canal isn't just a channel between two oceans. In fact, it doesn't use ocean water. It runs on fresh water pouring in from 17 artificial interconnected lakes.
Everything works by gravity.
Jorge de la Guardia says the water flows down into a series of locks, or lanes as they're sometimes called here. These locks gradually raise each ship 85 feet above sea level. De la Guardia says that takes a lot of water.
A full transit going from the Pacific or the Atlantic Oceans, from ocean to ocean, will take about 55 million gallons of fresh water.
And it's your job to make sure there's enough water to keep the ships moving.
Yes.
The Panama Canal already consumes three times as much water in a day as the city of Los Angeles. When the new lane for big ships is built, the canal will need even more. The question is, will there be enough? Stanley Hecadon Moreno works at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute in Panama City. He says the lakes that feed the canal are vulnerable to the climate fluctuation known as El Niño.
What if the theory of global warming were to increase the number of El Niño events, which will bring greater and more devastating droughts to the isthmus, and water will become definitely scarcer for the canal?
El Niños in 1997 and 1998 left the canal so short of water that ships had to unload part of their cargo to keep from running aground. It was the worst drought in the canal's history, and it disrupted shipping around the world. No one really knows whether climate change is going to make El Niños more frequent, but Hecadon sees some ominous trends.
Inside the canal watershed, inside the valley of the Chagres River, there has been an effect on that micro watershed. And there has been a decrease in rainfall.
So far, that's probably got more to do with the huge number of trees cut down than with climate change. But the result is the same, and officials are worried.
That's NPR's John Hamilton reporting. And this is one of the most emailed stories right now at npr.org. You can see the full list of most stories at our website, npr.org/BryantPark.